This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
The clock has struck 11:30, which means that this next half hour on the 3CR airwaves is dedicated to our coasts and oceans. You're listening to Out of the Blue. My name is Tessa Campisi, and I pay my respect to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians and caretakers of the unceded lands and waters from which we broadcast. I extend gratitude to this landscape. Although it may lie under layers of concrete and bitumen, it is very much alive. Eels still wriggle their way through the stormwater drain pipes underneath the city on their long journey home from their breeding grounds in the Coral Sea. And migratory shorebirds still fly all the way from the Siberian tundra to feed in the mudflats near the Williamstown docks. They carry their stories, these double helix threads, woven into the tapestry of life which is bound to this landscape. Today on the show, we'll be hearing a little bit more about the deeply complex work of migratory shorebird conservation. More after this.
Want to open the door to opportunities? Discover Learn Local, right in the heart of your community. Build confidence in reading and writing. Gain work and life skills while supporting family. Learn Local, a wide range of low-cost courses at over 200 locations across Victoria. Your goals, your way. Visit vic.gov.au/learnlocal-First Nations to start exploring now. Authorised by the Victorian Government, Melbourne.
A 3CR supporter.
Living with arthritis can bring tough questions. How do I manage the pain? What treatments work? Will it ever get better? It can feel overwhelming. That's why the Arthritis Info Line is here to help. It's a toll-free service with trained staff who understand arthritis and can provide answers, support and resources. If you're living with arthritis or caring for someone who is, call 1-800-011-041 or visit arthritisaustralia.com.au/infoline. You don't have to face it alone.
A 3CR supporter.
A couple of weeks ago on Out of the Blue, I had Dr. Sandy Webb on the show to talk about the campaign to protect an area known as the Crystals, just near Jawbone Marine Sanctuary in Williamstown. We spoke about some of the delights to be found there, but above the waves, in the mudflats and salt marshes, you can find some of Australia's migratory shorebird species. One of those species is the black-tailed godwit, which has recently been listed as endangered in New South Wales. On today's show, we chat to Professor Richard Fuller, an academic at the University of Queensland, about the fascinating biology and conservation plight of this migratory shorebird.
Was there a particular moment when you realised that this was the pathway you wanted to take, or was it a particular bird?
I think I'm one of those people that's been fascinated by nature ever since I was a tiny kid. And, you know, speaking to my family, it came from nowhere, this kind of little kid with this passion for nature and, you know, heading into the woods and studying, watching ants running around and just everything to do with nature all the time. I was really into dinosaurs for a long time and then realised they're kind of all extinct and you have to study them pretty indirectly. And then I sort of found birds and I thought, this is brilliant. Everywhere we go, there's birds and they're always doing something interesting. Many of them are beautiful, colourful, annoying, right? They're in your face all the time. And that's a beautiful thing, opportunity to study nature in a way that's accessible to all of us. So ever since then, I've really been hooked on birds and I've became quite an obsessive bird watcher from a very young age.
It's interesting that you had this interest in dinosaurs, because aren't birds evolved from dinosaurs?
Well, that's right. Technically, birds are living dinosaurs. So there was some continuity there that even at the time I didn't realise that wasn't really known about back then. But they absolutely are the sort of living descendants of dinosaurs. And that's kind of cool.
They've been around for a long time, have very interesting stories. In terms of migratory shorebirds, Australia has quite a number, with 37 species which regularly visit our shores. And among them is the black-tailed godwit, whose scientific name is Limosa limosa, which I think sounds like some sort of delicious drink. But basically, I understand that it's Latin for muddy, muddy. So can you tell me a little bit about this muddy, muddy bird?
Yeah, migratory shorebirds love mud. As their name suggests, they live on shorelines. So the junction between, wet and dry, if you like, that's their jam. That's what they inhabit. So they rely on wetlands, but they don't like it too wet or too dry. So they're constantly on the search for that kind of soft sediment. Many of them have long beaks. The black-tailed godwit has an enormously long beak. And they feed by probing that beak into the sediment, into the soft sediment, right? So there needs to be this kind of soft sediment that's accessible to the bird, that has plenty of food inside it. And what looks to us like a kind of lifeless, stinky mud flat, to a bird, that's a restaurant absolutely teeming with food. And, they probe into the sediment with their long bills, and they have sensory mechanisms at the tip of their bill, and they can actually move the tip of their bill around and search out little food items that are under the sediment. It's a really appropriate name for black-tailed godwit. There are some other kinds of shorebirds that feed more on the surface and pick food off the surface. And in fact, all the shorebirds that visit Australia, they all have different shapes and sizes and different lengths of beaks, and they kind of almost share out all the bounty on offer at this fast food restaurant among them. And that's why there are so many species really that can coexist within this same habitat.
So, how do shorebirds contribute to the functioning of the broader coastal ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean they absolutely take vast amounts of food, right? So they're really important consumers in sort of marine and coastal ecosystems. They're doing things on intertidal mud flats that, when the tide goes out, those birds are active and participating in that ecosystem. When the tide comes in, it's fish and marine, it turns into a marine environment. So there's really that kind of interchange there between land and sea. Because many of the species are migratory, their bodies themselves are a huge transfer of biomass that moves up and down these flyways. So you have thousands and thousands of tons of shorebirds pushing into the Arctic in the summer and bringing bountiful food resources into the Arctic for predators that have been hibernating over the winter period up in the Arctic, suddenly have this giant food resource that's become available because these birds are migrating there. So the shorebirds are changing their ecology all the time. They're probing in the soft mud down here in Australia, then they're flying up to these Arctic breeding grounds where they're kind of nose to jowl with bears and so on. It's just incredible, their
Yeah.
ecology.
It's extraordinary to think about that flow of material and energy from like a little worm growing in the mud flats of the east coast of Australia, eventually feeding maybe an Arctic fox. Wild to think of it on that global scale of how the resources are moved around by the system.
That's exactly right. And those movements also play a big role in human societies. The arrival of shorebirds is celebrated by human societies around the world, provides enormous resources for indigenous people living in Arctic regions, for example, where, again, there's very limited food supply over the winter period. And the arrival of that spring period and these billions of birds migrating into the Arctic is a deep part of the culture among indigenous people in high latitudes, but also all around the world. In Korea, there's an enormous Welcome the Shorebirds festival that happens each year, and it's just amazing the sheer number of people that are interested.
I know that there's down on the southwest coast of Victoria, there's an upwelling festival for the bonny upwelling, or the upwelling of nutrients from the deep ocean. And as it wells up, then it causes these algal blooms, and then that feeds the whole ecology of the marine system. And so, yeah, there's a celebration the community does, calling in the upwelling and celebrating what it gives them. And it's really beautiful to see when humans acknowledge and celebrate the machinations of the natural world.
Exactly, that's right. It helps us engage and understand what's happening around us. On the Sunshine Coast here, there's a Welcome to the Shorebirds festival that happens each year, and it's a great weekend, and people love doing it.
So tell me a little bit more about this migration route. How far does a black-tailed godwit fly, and where does it go exactly?
A very long way. So a black-tailed godwit that's, foraging somewhere in New South Wales, for example, maybe spending the summer months down here, probing away on its mudflat, just quietly going about its business, then starts to increase its food intake, puts on a lot of weight, and is really feeding furiously, needs to be kind of left alone at that point and not disturbed too much so it can put on all this energy. So the birds are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, building up these fat resources. Then one day, a little group of them will decide it's time to go. They're kind of restless and they know they need to go somewhere. So they'll take off and kind of circle around up into the sky. And then sometimes they go up and then, nah, they come back down again and carry on for a few more days. Then they'll go up again and think now's the time. And they'll start heading north. Black-tailed godwits from Australia go pretty much in a beeline. So they'll be heading purposefully and fast and pretty high in the sky. They can't land on the sea during their migration. So it's flapping flight the whole way. They don't glide, they
Oh.
don't land on the sea. And black-tailed godwits will migrate across the highlands of New Guinea, Indonesia, across Southeast Asia, through the Philippines, up through southern China. Many of them will then land in the Yellow Sea region, which is a large sea between the Korean Peninsula and the east coast of China. Then they'll drop down and feed. So there's some enormous mudflats in that region, absolutely enormous, 15-kilometer wide mudflats. So you can't even
Wow.
see the sea when the tide is out. So they'll land in those mudflats and then voraciously feed to refuel. By this time, they've flown nearly 10,000 kilometres, depending on where they've come from. And they're absolutely exhausted. Their energy reserves are low. They'll feed up furiously for a few weeks. Then they'll push north again. As the snow melt is occurring further north, they'll be pushing north against the edge of that green up, the kind of wave of green up in the northern spring. Black-tailed godwits will push on to the grasslands of Mongolia, northeastern China, and various marshy grasslands around eastern Russia, across quite a broad range of latitude from the border with China right through to subarctic Russia. So black-tailed godwits breed across a very large area. So they'll arrive on their breeding grounds. There may even still be snow on the ground. It may still be a bit cold, but they'll hang out there and wait for that snow melt to occur. Then they'll get underway and start building their nests.
When they do their first migration, do they do it with others and learn the way, or is it something that's just innate that they know which path to take?
Yeah, most shorebirds, after they're born, it takes them a while to become fully able to fly strongly, right, and to really be able to undertake the migration. So in a kind of mass parental desertion event, most of the parents actually leave first from the Arctic breeding grounds. They're like, all right, see you later, good luck then. And the parents go off on their southward migration. The young shorebirds, they're kind of left up there to finish their maturation, and then to begin their migration south. They don't have any experience of having done that migration before, and it's absolutely mind-blowing that they're able to do this.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio, and we've been hearing from migratory shorebird expert Dr. Richard Fuller about the black-tailed godwit's epic migration from Australia to the Arctic. But every year, there are less and less birds who make this journey. In July this year, the black-tailed godwit was listed as endangered in New South Wales, having seen a decline of almost 80% since the 90s. And this trend is alarmingly common among migratory shorebirds. A 2015 study showed that of 1,500 birds analysed, 91% were inadequately protected. Compare this to 65% among non-migratory species. So I asked Richard why conservation of migratory shorebirds proves so challenging.
Yeah, so we've just been talking about these incredible migration journeys of these birds. In the case of the black-tailed godwit, they're leaving Australia where they need great quality feeding habitat to build up their energy reserves But then they also need to find great quality feeding habitat, for example, in China or Korea or Japan, where they also need to refuel. And then they need to find great quality breeding habitat in Russia, right? So they're dependent there, for example, on three or four countries and different locations as they move along their migration routes. And prior to humans kind of messing around a lot with habitats, that was fine. That worked because where you went last year would also be a great place this year and next year and for the next 100 years or thousands of years. But since humans have begun, intensely modifying and changing habitats, particularly along coastlines, right, which is what these shorebirds depend on. Suddenly, a bird can show up on a migration 1 year, and the habitat they've used for the last 500 years is not there anymore. And that is exceptionally challenging for a migrating bird that is so exquisitely programmed to stop at that location and refuel. And it doesn't carry too much spare fuel. That's a waste of energy. It's got to land and it's got to feed. And if that habitat has gone, it's in big, big trouble. And that's when we see large declines of migratory species happening, right? They depend on this intact chain of habitats and sites along their migration journey. And if only one of those sites in that chain is impacted by human activity of one sort or another, it could be hunting or habitat loss or whatever, then that entire migration route is compromised because of that. And that's why migratory species are acutely at risk of habitat impacts. And it could be, if you think about it, a habitat impact somewhere thousands of kilometres away could cause birds in New South Wales to decline, right? And understanding those linkages is really important. With black-tailed godwits, around 60% of them, of all the ones in our entire flyway, end up here in Australia. So what happens here in Australia is how the birds are doing here is a good index of how they're doing across the whole migration flyway, if that makes sense.
I'm curious how climate change also factors into this. For example, given the godwit migrates north at the time of the wet season, it's much known about how the birds navigate cyclones.
Weather has a huge impact on migrations for sure. So if a bird encounters a storm event, it is not going to go straight through it. Some seabirds are very well adapted to major storms and they actually use them to slingshot and they actually use them to their favor. Shorebirds will try to avoid them or be heavily disrupted by them. There was a Far Eastern curlew, for example, that was blown about 2,500 kilometers off route by a huge storm over the Philippines and it ended up in Borneo, which is well outside where it would normally go. So that there have been storms are immensely disturbing for migratory birds. And in many cases, they'll turn back actually and go back. So if storms are increasing in intensity, duration, and frequency and occurring in places where they didn't before, that will be disruptive. Climate change more generally is, of course, absolutely also a huge threat. There are some populations of the black-tailed godwit which breed in the far north, almost at the edge of the Arctic, around the Arctic Circle. And climate change is happening super fast in those areas. And climate warming is causing the permafrost layer, which is just under the surface of the tundra, to melt and to drop down. So the entire surface dries out, and the birds no longer have access to the wetland habitats they need. And there's been lots of studies showing that climatically suitable conditions in the northern breeding grounds for all these birds are declining super fast and really quickly. And I think that's also part of the reason that the birds are declining so quickly. But also, there's been other impacts on their breeding grounds, such as changes in agricultural practice, which in themselves can be driven by climate change, with farmers seeking out new crops and doing agriculture in new places. So a lot of these threats are all kind of interlinked with each other.
So you're outlining a scenario where there seems to be a lot of change happening very quickly. But there is also some research coming out of your research lab, which has shown that species such as the pied avocet and the black-faced spoonbill have shown some improvements in their population numbers. Can you explain a little bit about how these migratory shorebirds have been able to adapt and improvise with anthropogenic structures?
Interesting you raised that. That's right. So the black-faced spoonbill and the pied avocet, we've been studying those two species. They don't occur in Australia, but they are interesting. They're much more adapted to human-produced wetlands, right? So those two species, for example, are quite happy living in salt pans, living in quite modified coastal landscapes, lagoons created by building seawalls, for example, and they can use those areas as artificial habitats, if you like. And that has been, at least we think, partly responsible for those species doing a little bit better. So, certainly, species that can cope and can use a broader range of habitats tend to be doing slightly better. Those who are very dependent, particularly on coastal mudflats, are in more trouble because there's really no other substitute for an intertidal mudflat. There's no kind of human artificial coastal wetland that's going to look, it's going to be like a tidal mudflat. So the loss of those tidal areas has been really important, I think, in causing so many species to decline so quickly. We think about two-thirds of the mudflats in the Yellow Sea region have disappeared in the last 50 years. So that's 1.6 million hectares of mudflats used to be in the Yellow Sea, and now there's 600,000. And very few species, if you're using that habitat, very few of them are also able to use other kinds of habitat as well. The other thing I would say is that there have been extensive conservation actions, particularly for the black-faced spoonbill. That species has been heavily helped on its breeding grounds by really careful management. And that's enabled the breeding pairs to produce many more young. That bird was on the brink of extinction, the absolute brink, down to the last few hundred birds. And it's now recovered to many, many thousands. And it's an absolute conservation success story. And we have emerging evidence that some of the migratory shorebirds are also beginning to slow their rate of decline. There's been big progress made in China and Korea, slowing down the amount of coastal habitat reclamation that's been happening. The loss of the mudflats is slowing down now. And I think we're beginning to see that in the birds, that many of the declines are now starting to stabilize, which is great news. But many of them are so much rarer than they used to be. You know, there's a big question mark. Where do we go from here in terms of their conservation?
So what I'm hearing is that these birds, although yes, they can use these anthropogenic structures, it's not like, oh yeah, they'll be right, they'll find a way. That there has been some really strategic, active conservation that's had to occur alongside that for those numbers to increase again.
That's absolutely right. I don't know of an acutely threatened species that spontaneously recovered without intense human effort. So you're absolutely right. And also, both within large countries like Australia, there needs to be cooperation and collaboration among different parts of the migration route, and of course, with other countries too. And Australia does have migratory bird agreements with China, Korea, and Japan. Those discussions and actions have been a key part of the story so far in helping these birds.
Yes, and this is something that I wanted to raise, that supporting migratory birds to thrive, I think, really illustrates the complexity of natural systems, that you can't address them in isolation. So I'm curious about what kinds of governance arrangements or initiatives have emerged, and which ones you're most excited about.
Yeah, ever since the 1970s, we saw the emergence of bilateral agreements, right? So countries recognized that birds were migrating between them and set up bilateral agreements. So Japan signed an agreement with Australia, for example. And there's a bird called the Latham snipe that migrates pretty much entirely between Australia and Japan. And that species was hunted in both Australia and in Japan at that time. And there was real concern that that hunting was going to lead to possibly even the extinction of that species. And under the Migratory Bird Agreement between those two countries, it was decided to ban hunting for the Latham snipe in both of those countries. And that was a spectacular success. The Latham snipe did not rapidly decline. And although it's threatened here and there, by and large, that species has remained relatively stable compared to many of the other shorebirds, right? So those kind of discussions, they may be sort of high level, but they can be really influential on the ground in actually generating actions that will help. In that case, action was taken in both parts, in the breeding grounds and in the non-breeding grounds, in a coordinated way, and that led to, a really improved conservation status for that species. Since then, we've also seen more multilateral agreements as well. Probably the kind of crown jewels, if you like, in that space in our flyway is the East Asian Australasian Flyway Partnership. And that's a huge mouthful to say, but it's a group of 22 plus countries, plus 17 or more NGOs. It's a kind of semi-formal but voluntary arrangement. Governments participate in that, as do NGOs and various community groups. And it's a really great example of multilateral cooperation, information sharing the thrills and spills, the wins and losses, in kind of an honest way. And I think that's been enormously influential. Some really big policy decisions by China and Korea to designate a whole bunch of World Heritage properties along their coastlines to protect the most important remaining habitat. Much of that has been enabled and come out of international cooperation. The Australian government was very influential in securing the success of those World Heritage nominations at the World Heritage Committee. And I just think it shows that international trust and cooperation really does deliver conservation action on the ground. A lot of us are frustrated about the slow pace, but when you have a 20-year span and you look at it, you think, well, when I started working on these birds, it was just absolute despair. And we just felt nothing was ever going to happen. But just over that time, gradually, bit by bit, there's more and more discussions happening, more and more people know and care, and more action is being taken. So I'm more hopeful now than I ever have been.
Dr. Richard Falither, migratory shorebird expert from the University of Queensland. And I have to say, Richard might be the first truly optimistic ecologist I've ever met. After our interview, I was left feeling really hopeful too, and inspired by the capacity of humans to tackle these wicked problems in the name of a shared love for our avian kin. Richard's research lab, the Fuller Lab, is doing all sorts of cool research, which you can read about at fullerlab.org. That's FullerLab.org. You can find that link on our website, where you can listen back to past episodes of Out of the Blue at 3cr.org.au/radioblue. And that's it from me. Stay tuned for Out of the Pan, coming up next with Sally. Until next time, stay salty.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.